This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. In just a moment here, we will be talking with Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. She's been here before on the program, one of a group of physicians here from our community that gives a little bit of their time so they can answer questions. And we hope that these shows help you, maybe add to your knowledge about health. I always say, but when we have a doctor on the phone, is we can't do a diagnosis over the phone, but we can give out some good basic information. And that's what we try to do with these shows, and we will talk with her in just a moment. We also would like to talk with you all who are listening, me and Molly Delaney, who is here with me, about supporting the station. That's also what we're here to do. We're coming near the end of our fiscal year. That ends next week. And the money for next year's programming all has to be in the bank. So whatever money's going to go for next year's shows, that's it. That's why it's so important for us to meet our fundraising goal for the year. And we are very close, but we want to get there, and hopefully we can go beyond it. And the way we do that is by getting people to call or getting people to go online and making a financial pledge financial support to the station. Now, that's real easy to say, but Molly, why is it so hard?
Well, I would say for many of our listeners, it's not hard. You know, we do get a great deal of support from the community, from our membership. But we also know that a much greater percentage of people out there listening have never pledged before. And so I'm going to ask you to step up today and make that call of support at 244-9455 or to go to willpledge.org and let us know that this is the kind of programming you want to see continue. This is always my favorite part of Focus, is when we totally shift gears. This is great. We've gone from this emotional, gut-wrenching show to complete informative. Claudia, I'm really hoping you're not going to make me tear up at all. I'm hoping that the topic of gastroenterology does not make me start to tear up. But this is the kind of spectrum that we cover on Focus, and it's one of the reasons that I really value this show. And I just got handed, oh my goodness, we have $38 to go in this hour to reach our goal of $1,000 during Focus and $5,000 during the morning here at WILL. Wow. Three calls so far, four web pledges, $38. Oh my gosh, we can do that. Let's up it.
Well, we're just going to have to double it.
We are.
Just going to have to say we're just going to have to raise $1,000 before noon.
Before noon. We can do it.
Right.
We can do it.
And maybe one real quick, I do want to mention the drawing we have.
Because
this is pretty cool.
Right.
As an incentive for people to pledge. Now, it's not required, but we would like people to call in and make a pledge. We have two passes to next year's Ebert Fest, the Ebert Film Festival that happens in the spring. And it's a really cool thing.
Yeah, not just one film.
That's right. As many films as you can stand. Three films in a day. I went for the first time this year, and I didn't even manage to get to all the films, and I think I saw a dozen films in like 3 days. It's a great experience. They're wonderful movies. And to be able to see it in the Virginia Theater, it's just a spectacular place to be. And the screen is so big.
Yeah,
you know, we
beautiful.
Forgot what it was like to go to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful place to see films. So, we have a drawing. We have two passes for the entire festival for next year. Anyone, you can call in, get your name in the drawing, and we'll do the drawing at 3 o'clock.
Right, before 3.
Before, just right before
call
3
before
o'clock.
Call before 3.
No pledges required. We'd really like it if you would, but you don't have to. And that's just one more way we're trying to get people to go to the phone to make a pledge.
Exactly.
So we'll stop there for the moment. We'll talk more about supporting the station in a little bit. But what now, we want to give people an opportunity to listen to our guest for this hour. And if you have questions about her area of specialty, you can give us a call. Dr. Claudia Nugent, she is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic and has been here before on the program to talk about digestive matters. And we're really pleased you could be here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
having
me. Glad to be here.
I was just thinking, I don't know if this is a too difficult a question, but I was thinking this, you know, that everybody, it seems like, people have different ways that they register stress bodies.
True.
Muscle aches and joint aches and headaches and all kinds of stuff. Well, one of those places that people stress shows up is in the gut. And that's why we got ulcers and we got colitis and all kinds of other things like that. So why is that? Is there an answer for why it is that that stress often shows up in your stomach?
I think the best answer to that was actually explained to me by one of my mentors, Dr. Barnett, if anyone remembers him from the town.
Saul Barnett?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So one of my favorite teachers. And he once referred to an article from the New York Times, which he always said was his second best medical journal, which I thought was good. Mm-hmm. And there was an article about how complex the neurologic part of the gut was, and all the neuroreceptors and the chemicals that are released for to tell the gut to do this, that, and the other, and how it was even more complex maybe than the brain even. And so when you have stress, there are certain neurochemicals that get released naturally, and they all have effect on, can potentially affect on all the parts of our body, but lots of them have effect on our gut. There are a lot of psychiatric medicines that release serotonin or inhibit other neurochemicals, and that all has, we know, there are receptors in the gut that also are affected. So it's quite complex, and I don't think we understand even half of it.
Yeah, okay, so. Very interesting. Well, let me, you know, I don't think I gave the call-in numbers here, and I would really encourage people who are listening, if you have questions, would like to talk with Dr. Nugent, to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers just to call in. Nobody's going to shake you down for a contribution. We hope you will make a pledge, but that's not required. So again, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Also, we have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting is it seems like, oh, you know, over time, maybe the within your practice, I wonder how things have shifted. So were there, you know, maybe before reflux became so big, what was really the thing that you maybe saw, you would have seen more or dealt with more than than anything else?
Probably ulcer problems. Before, well, gosh, and I don't think I've been in practice that long. I'm not that old yet. 19 years, but I know even in my medical school days, we didn't have a whole lot of medicines that to use for ulcer problems, except for the antacids. And to realistically get healing from antacids, you have to take them every 2 hours in order to change the pH in the stomach. And so there wasn't a whole lot there. Then during my training, they developed the H2 blockers, which are medicines like Tagamet, Pepcid, Zantac, which is one of the pathways for acid production, but it's one of the minor pathways. So now we had something at least to suppress the acid production somewhat, but they weren't super strong. And then during my residency and then fellowship, again, very recently, the proton pump inhibitors, which are Prilosec, Nexium, et cetera, Prevacid, came out, and those are much more potent, much stronger at healing ulcer problems and then keeping them healed. In addition to that, Helicobacter pylori, H. pylori, has also been discovered and worked with, and we realize that that has also got a significant input in ulcer formation and recurrence of ulcers. And so I think we're seeing a lot less ulcer problems than we used to. So that certainly has changed significantly in very recent times.
Yeah. Okay. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. And they're in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My son has ulcerative colitis. And he was living in Chicago and went to a doctor up there. And then he moved down here so he could get a job. And now everything I suggest to him, he refuses to do, and he's, you know, one day he'll be okay, and then and other days he won't. So what do I do? How do I help him?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I'll do best I can with it. Ulcerative colitis is an inflammation in the colon, and it can affect anywhere in the colon.
Oh, and then his bowel movements, he had blood and mucus.
Yeah, and there are actually ulcers that form. Sometimes it affects only the rectum. Sometimes it can be the entire colon. So
no, it's just in the rectum and the anus.
Okay, so he has an ulcerative proctitis, which traditionally is a little bit easier to control. It sometimes will give a bit less symptoms. The issues, however, is that it gives real variable symptoms. And since we don't understand the disease incredibly well, there are times it will just go away on its own, and then other times it will get worse again. There are a lot of different therapies that can be tried. It really depends on what the situation is and what he's willing to do. It's certainly a hassle. There are certainly some risks with colon cancer if it's up higher. Usually ulcerative proctitis does not have an increased colon cancer risk. But there certainly are medicines that can be used to help make life certainly a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you tell me your name?
Claudia Nugent.
Claudia Nugent, and you're at Carl?
I'm at Christie.
Oh, you're at Christie.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I want to write that down. Wait a minute. Say it again.
Claudia Nugent. Do you know Ted Nugent, the rock singer?
No.
Oh, that's good, because he's...
I always use that name. Related.
No, I'm not related. Well, I always use that name connection, but it's Nugent, N-U-G-E-N-T.
Okay, and you're at Christie.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well,
good luck.
Thank you, and we will talk again. Another caller here. This is also someone in Urbana, and line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Doctor, I have endoscopy scheduled for next month, and I've had some, acid reflux problems for about a year and 2 months now, and I have been treating it first with Prevacid and then Zantac, which is what I'm taking now, and I'm about to switch to Prilosec on the recommendation of my doctor, but... what I wonder is there, I guess I don't know exactly what the causes are, what I'd like to know is how is that determined? Are there some tests that try to pinpoint the problem, and are different problems treated differently? So if you could kind of enlighten me on that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Are your questions is how is reflux disease diagnosed, or and what causes it, or am I getting that question right?
Yes. I'd like to know what causes it and what various treatments are there. I mean, I think somebody told me that there could be a protein could be a problem. But I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to me, I guess, what the treatments are, at least over-the-counter, are what I stated earlier. I mean, are those general treatments for any cause?
Actually, you bring up an interesting question. Reflux disease... for the most part, we think is caused by the lower esophageal sphincter, the muscle in the lower esophagus being a little bit too weak, or pressures in the stomach being too great and overcoming the strength of that lower muscle, so it allows contents in the stomach to go into the esophagus. Traditionally, that's acid for the most part, although bile can also play a role in that. But traditionally, it's an acid issue. And we all have some what we consider a normal amount of reflux where there is a little bit of stomach contents that comes into the lower esophagus, but not more than a certain amount of time in 24 hours. Most of us don't have symptoms from that. Some people, however, do. But most of the time, that will not actually cause any damage to the esophagus. When you have your endoscopy, it can tell if there's been damage or irritation to the esophagus. It also can make sure you're not dealing with an ulcer problem or other issues that might present with similar symptoms. So if it's a reflux issue, the things that lower that lower esophageal sphincter muscle are just the way you're built. And a lot of people have reflux issues, so obviously a lot of us are built with a kind of a weak muscle. But also there are certain things that can make a muscle that's already weak or make an intact muscle weaker. And there are certain foods that actually can promote reflux problems. Caffeine, mint, and then there's a chemical in tomatoes that can actually relax that lower esophageal sphincter muscle and potentiate the ability for reflux to occur. certainly if you eat bigger meals, that puts more, and then especially if you lie down shortly thereafter, that puts more pressure on that muscle. If your stomach is not emptying correctly, that puts more pressure on that muscle and things can come back. So there's a lot of different issues that are involved. As far as therapy goes, yeah, generally you try to control the reflux, and 90% of the time that does take care of it. Medicines like Prevacid and Prilosec are very strong controllers of acid, as I mentioned earlier. Zantac is not quite as strong, but sometimes it's enough to take care of people's symptoms. So it really depends on the severity of the issue and other factors that are involved. Some things you can control yourself just with lifestyle, and other things not. So it depends, again, on how bad the problem is.
I see. Well, you mentioned stress earlier, and about a year, a little over a year ago, I was under a tremendous amount of stress, and so I tend to think that that might have been a factor in causing the reflux, but, you know, I'm not certain of that.
Well, actually, this is great because you've tied everything in together that we've talked about today. Stress can cause neurochemicals to be released that actually have an effect on the gut, and we know that it increases acid production. So, yeah, it can cause more stomach problems. Stress can also cause a lot of stomach problems that are not even acid-related, too. But that has been shown.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I think that it is true that for some people who complain of reflux symptoms, that the easiest things, one, to lose weight if you need to, two, look at your diet and see, right, you know, what you're eating. That actually, for some people at least, that right there can help, and they don't even need to go on to take medicine.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But see, that's the hardest thing to do, is to change your lifestyle. It's easier to pop a pill.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask you about the pills then. You talked about the fact that over time, what you had went from, first you just had antacid, so you got Tums, something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Then you got your H2
blockers,
Tagamet and Zantac. And then the next generation came along, the proton pump inhibitors. Those are all those things that end in Zole, like Omeprazole,
right,
and Soprazole and whatever. Now, that's your Prevacid and your Prilosec. And now already Prilosec you can get that as a generic.
Exactly.
So time marches on with pharma. Are the companies that make those things, are they developing something new? Well, someday they'll come to you and say, "Doctor, we have this wonderful new thing for you to give your patients, and it works even better."
Sure, there may be something, but there's actually nothing in the works, because the proton pump inhibitors they work so well. The hydrogen pump is the main mechanism of getting acid produced, putting that hydrochloric acid, into the stomach. So if you block that, one of the side mechanisms is the histamine receptors, which is why that's how the Tagamets and the Zantacs work. But that does not put much acid in there. The other issue is, you know, there's a reason we have acid in our stomach. And some of the potential side effects that have at least we've had some concerns about, you don't want to totally shut off the acid if there's a reason that needs to be there. So, you know, there's probably not going to be just here, take this medicine, you'll never have reflux again. Mm. But we'll see what comes. Keep an open mind.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. We're talking about digestive health. Whatever questions you might have, you can give us a call. As you're reaching for the Tums, you might also reach for the phone and dial 244-9455, or you can go online at willpledge.org and make a financial contribution to this station. Believe me, you'll feel much better. That burning sensation, it'll just completely go away, because you'll feel so good about supporting. Have I gone too far?
No,
yet?
You're right on.
Okay.
You're right on.
Good. Yeah. That burning sensation will go away, and it will be replaced by the cool, positive, happy feeling that goes with supporting the station. Okay, I'll stop there. This is one of those times that we ask people directly to support the station. We do this show all the time without breaks. And, you know, one of the things we do is programs like this. And we've really been so fortunate that many physicians here in the community have given their time to come to be with us and to answer questions. And And they've been really so great. And I hope we've helped people by at least dispensing some basic information. So, you know, if you like this show because of health, or you like the show because of the authors we talk to, or whatever reason, if it's been a good resource for you, well, how about supporting the station where the show exists? That's what we're asking you to do. Molly Delaney's here with me. I'm so very happy she's here. She's our education outreach director and is here to help me encourage people to go to the phones.
David, you've left me a little speechless this morning because usually you save the bad puns for me. So I'm like, you stole all the good ones.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
But we do want you to feel good about supporting the station, whether you're reaching for Tums or not. And this is the kind of practical information that you can find on our station every single day. It's for me, it's always this stunning example of what we do here, where this is really stuff that helps people in their day-to-day living. And so we thank Claudia for being here and all of the other physicians who've contributed their time. I'm going to switch and talk a little bit about those the wonderful passes that we have for Ebert Fest. Because, you know, once your stomach is feeling better, you'll want to go out and enjoy yourself. And today only, if you call in before 3 p.m. today, we have these wonderful two free passes to Ebert Fest next year, which is April 17th through the 21st. It's a very popular event. Those passes are not even available to the general public. So in addition to great information, horrible puns from the host, and you also get this opportunity to win these two free passes. You don't have to make a pledge, but we would certainly appreciate it if you did. But we need to hear from you at 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org before 3 p.m. this afternoon.
Yeah, and you can help us with our big fundraising goals. And this the new goal that we set like 20 minutes ago, that we need to raise another $1,000 before
1,038
before noon. Because Molly said we could do $1,000 over 2 hours. We practically did that and won.
We did. We got very close.
Nothing to it. Give us a hard one. So now we say, well, okay, I guess we just have to raise another $1,000 before noon.
Right, exactly. And whatever you can afford to contribute, we'll take. And I'm going to make that bad pun again. Consider it your copay.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Seriously. 244-9455 or willpledge.org. Okay, let's talk with, again, some callers here. Get back to business. Belgium is here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. Mm-hmm. I've had several friends who have had heart problems and heart surgery and stuff, and they all say that after they've had heart surgery, their stomachs cause problems. Is there some sort of a relationship between your heart and your stomach?
So after their surgery, their stomachs got worse?
Well, they had problems with it. They can't eat certain things. They have bowel problems. They have all kinds of stuff that goes with it. And I thought, is that just a coincidence, or is there some kind of connection?
Well, I don't know for sure. There are certainly some medicines that you probably would be put on after heart surgery, including aspirin, which might affect your stomach, because all medicines affect the GI tract, probably, potentially at least. It might be that their heart feels so much better that now they're sensing they have stomach issues, which they kind of didn't notice that before. So I think there's a lot of different potentials. I think medicine would probably be way up there. As far as relationships specifically, probably not that I'm aware of.
Thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thank you. Here, I have a couple of questions that have come in by email. Someone writes that about a year ago, they were prescribed the Prilosec OTC, so that's the over-the-counter version, for chronic acid reflux suspected of inflaming their vocal cords. And the listener is wondering, should I be concerned about taking Prilosec OTC on an open-ended basis?
Open-ended, I assume means long-term.
It means like, yes, I'm saying that, yeah.
There have been some concerns that have been raised about long-term proton pump inhibitor therapy. One of those has been whether there is an increased risk of osteoporosis because of decreased calcium absorption. And I will put down iron deficiency as well, since iron is also absorbed better in an acid medium, as is calcium, which is why there is potentially a problem. There's also been issues as to whether it inactivates or decreases activity of Plavix, which is an important medicine in keeping stents open for heart or for carotid artery issues. There has been a question of whether we are increasing the risk of pneumonia because now you're not killing bacteria, especially in an intensive care unit setting. where people are at increased risk of aspiration. I think the most recent issue has been whether we're increasing the potential for a bacterial colitis called Clostridium difficile colitis. And all of these are, there are so many other things that come together that there certainly has never been a cause effect that had been proven between the two. I think that the most documented issue probably is whether there is an increased risk of osteoporosis because of calcium absorption. But that is very easily overcome by increasing the amount of calcium you take. And I respect the research that has gone into this certainly very much. But if you look at patients that have had stomach surgeries where the acid-producing part of their stomach has been removed, they've never shown an association between osteoporosis and in those patients. And they actually have they have no acid production. Mm-hmm. And we know that they have so little acid production and that it does affect iron absorption. Those people do become anemic, but they don't develop osteoporosis issues. Now, patients on long-term proton pump inhibitors, if that affects calcium absorption, is probably very mild because it does not make people anemic. We've shown that that does not occur. So there's a lot of questions. I would say stay tuned. You have to balance some of those questionable risks against what is a definite benefit from taking the medicine. So if your vocal cord irritation is definitely a reflux-induced issue, then what is the risk that acid is going to either cause a cancer in the esophagus or vocal cords, which, again, that question is out there. And also, comfort measures as well play into that. So I would say long-term, there's some things that need to be followed up and considered. Overall, they still are very, very safe medicines.
Okay. Well, here's another email question that naturally follows from the last, because someone would like you to talk about Barrett's esophagus and what are the causes, and also they're interested in, is there any hereditary kind of link there? If someone close in your family had it, does that mean it's more likely that you might?
Right. Barrett's esophagus is a change in the lining of the esophagus from what is supposed to be there to a lining that is similar to what is in the stomach. For some reason, that's more unstable, however, in the esophagus. And there is a question whether it may increase the potential of progressing into esophageal cancer in a very low percentage of people. It's not high. But that association has definitely been made, and probably it is a cause, but again, not everybody goes into that issue. We think that Barrett's is caused by reflux. Why some people get Barrett's esophagus, changes in their esophagus from reflux, but the majority of people don't, we don't know. Whether it is hereditary or not, the answer is no, but there are some small subgroups that have been studied. I know Mayo Clinic had a study going on that shows that there are some familial groups of people that they definitely have an increased risk of developing Barrett's and esophageal cancer. And so there are some genetics that are probably involved with that. But for most people, that is not the case.
Okay. To another caller here, let's talk with them. Champagne Line 1. Hello.
You were talking earlier about ulcerative colitis. I've had that for decades, and I'm just wondering about the spectrum of treatments available for it, because I'm a little worried that the ones that I've been on are getting less effective. For some while, I'd been taking sulfasalazine, but I think my doctor had worried that there'd be, I think it was over the long-term risk of kidney damage, taking it lifelong. So I'm on a different drug now, but one exotic sort of treatment I'd heard about, and I wonder if you might say, is changing the bowel ecology with, I think, deploying intestinal parasites, I think helminths or something. They called it the diet of worms, it's a charming name. Anyway, I'm sort of wondering what's available for long-term treatment for ulcerative colitis.
Okay. Well, I have actually heard about that parasite therapy, but I would not go there if I were you. Ulcerative colitis, inflammatory bowel disease in general, is a problem. It's an autoimmune process where for some reason your white blood cells are attacking the colon, and we don't know why that occurs. So the therapies at this point have been aimed at decreasing inflammation generally. Medicines like sulfasalazine and mesalamine, which is azacol, pentaza, those types of things, are certainly out there. And traditionally, they have been considered to be first line. Both azacol-type medicines and sulfasalazine have a very rare potential for causing kidney problems, which I have never seen, but I have read about. So even with long-term therapy, that risk is quite low. And just monitoring your renal functions is usually enough to be able to catch it early enough so that you can stop the medicines, and then it will be reversible as long as it's caught early enough. There may be other, you know, reasons if you're at risk of having kidney issues from other diseases that you don't want to, your doctor doesn't want to potentiate problems, combine issues, which certainly I respect. Those are usually the first-line medicines. Second-line medicines are things like 6-mercaptopurine or azathioprine, which are immunomodulators. They affect your immune system, suppress it somewhat, and can be used for long-term therapy. They do have potential effect on the bone marrow, which is rare, but they have been used with very good effectiveness in many patients. Methotrexate is another one in that list as well. The newest medicines on the block are the biologic agents, and these are the anti-tumor necrosis factor agents, which are Humira, infliximab, which is Remicade, and Cimzia are the most common ones that are being used. Those actually block different processes in the inflammatory cascade nonspecifically. They work in the entire body. And they have had wonderful effectiveness and are certainly out there. They're either sub-Q injections or in an IV infusion is how they're given. They, however, also block any type of inflammation in the body. So if you have a cold or any other type of infection, you can't take the injection at that time. And that needs to be monitored very carefully because they're certainly a very powerful medicine and that you need to be respect. But they've been very, very helpful.
Okay, well, thank you then.
All right, very good. Thank you. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic, and she is here. We're talking a little bit about digestive health. And, you know, over the years, we've had a lot of physicians on the program. I think one of the things that people often complain about when they complain about medicine today is that they feel they don't get to spend enough time with their doctor so that they can ask questions. Or maybe, you know, you're at the doctor, and then the next day, you think, well, there's something I really wanted to ask, but I didn't get the chance to. So that's why we have always done shows like this to at least in part give you a chance to ask questions of a doctor. And so, you know, we have an OBGYN and we have a family practice doctor and they're here every other month. And then we have people with various specialties like Dr. Nugent, or, you know, we have an orthopedic guy and we have a foot guy and we have different parts of the body that we try to concentrate on. And it's all about trying to help you and give you some useful information. And that's all we tried to do really with the show over the years is as much as we can. I feel if we give people something, they can take something away from the program that's useful. That's good. I feel that we did good that day.
Your stomach feels good about that.
Yeah, stomach feels good about this. Good. Yeah, relief is just a swallow away. Then I feel good about what we've done. And we've done it for a while. So all I can say now is at this point is if you feel like you've got something out of this show or the other programs that we do, that you will be a partner with us. And that means being a financial supporter. Molly Delaney is here to help me make that argument.
And David, I'm just listening, you know, to what you were just saying and thinking myself, I've encountered some health problems recently. And it's very true. You don't get enough time with the people who are the most knowledgeable. So for Claudia Nugent to be here, giving her time to the station is incredible. And it also is just this opportunity to dispel some of the kind of myths that are out there. You know, you can self-seek information, which I encourage people to do. But at the same time, there's so much that is out there. This is really an opportunity to call in and specifically ask questions. And that doesn't happen very often, even if it's your own doctor about your own health. So again, our gratitude to everyone over the years who provided that service here at the station. And it's also our way of kind of keeping the community healthy. This has been an incredible program to listen to, and but we do need your support. And I just got another we have some great information. We got 6 calls in the 11 o'clock hour, 6 web pledges. We want to beat that in this hour. So far this morning, we've raised $5,742, which means we are not very far, David, from that $2,000 goal. So pretty exciting stuff. We need to hear from a few more callers. We did get one pledge of $365, a dollar a day. I think, you know, we could make some bad pun about a dollar a day and keeping the doctor away. This is great news, but we need to keep it going. So, again, we want to hear from you at 244-9455.
All right. Or you can go online if you want to do it that way. WillPledge.org. Either way, if you already support the station and you could maybe give it a little extra, oh, that would be wonderful. But if you listen and for whatever reason you're not a supporter, hey, how about now signing up at the most basic level? If everybody did that, we would be in good shape.
Absolutely. And don't forget, if you call before 3 o'clock today, you get your name in a drawing for two passes for Ebert Fest next spring.
All right. We have about 12-13 minutes left in this part of Focus with Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. So when she is here on the program, we talk about digestive matters. And so anything that is within her area of practice, you can give us a call. And we have a couple of people here, one at least, ready to go in Champaign. Line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I started to listen late, so I don't know if you happened to cover this, but I'm guessing you didn't. I have a recurring problem. I'm not sure you can help, but I'd like to give it a try. And that is that I have to go under general anesthesia like about once a year for a medical procedure. And every time they do that, for about 5 days afterwards, my bowels are all shut down and everything gets messed up. And my doctor doesn't seem to have any kind of advice on how to approach the whole thing. And I was wondering if you did.
Are you actually constipated where things just won't move, or things
right,
are real
right.
regular?
No, I'm constipated.
Okay. Do you take a fiber supplement like Metamucil or Benefiber or Citracell, any of those types of
Not
things?
On a regular basis, but around this period I try to, yeah.
Okay. How long is the procedure that you undergo? Is it a lengthy one, or, is it something just quick?
They're usually in there for about 2 hours.
Okay. I don't know what anesthetic is being used, as how that would affect things. I know that if there are any type of narcotic medicines that are being used, that can certainly slow down the gut. The things that you could potentially do is, it sounds like you've already started to do some of them. Certainly a fiber supplement, I would probably start it a week at least before you have the general anesthesia and continue it for at least another week, if not just long term, because it's certainly healthy long term. And then increase the amount of fluids that you're taking as much as possible, just make sure you stay very hydrated to keep enough fluid in the intestines so that you're not affected as much. I'm thinking along the lines of, when people travel, it just throws havoc to their GI system, and that's a common problem. And the fibers will help things continue to move. If that's not enough, you can actually take some low-dose, non-extreme laxatives like milk of magnesia or Miralax just to help you through that time until things start to work again. So those will be the suggestions I would have.
Is that a common thing that you see?
I've not heard that with anesthetics so much. But again, and I'm trying to piece together the different medicines that are used. I know for
they did tell me that because of pain, hydrocodone can cause constipation.
Exactly.
But this last time, I didn't take any afterwards, and I still had this problem.
Did you get pain medicines during the procedure, though? If they use any type, some of the anesthesia is combined a narcotic with the anesthetic. in which case that certainly could have an effect on your bowels.
Well, I'll have to ask, but and I guess what I could do is ask him not to use it this time nor next time.
Yeah, so. I mean, the other issue too, if it's an intra-abdominal procedure, that just by definition can slow things down and affect GI motility. So that would be
it is. It is, and it's doing my ureter and bladder.
Yeah, see that any type of intra-abdominal stuff can certainly affect the motility, and so you just have to work around it a little bit. And again, if the fiber is not enough, then certainly just taking a non-stimulant laxative would probably be enough to get you through.
Okay, well, I'll give it a try. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Good luck.
We'll go on to another caller here. This is someone in Champaign, and it would be line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
2 points. In defense of Dr. Nugent, she does spend time with you. She got all the questions. I come in with a list. She actually, every one, you know.
Great. Are you going to give us $38, too?
I already pledged.
Oh, okay. That's, you're off the hook then.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Thank you.
I pledged, you know. In fact, what happens, sometimes I forget, and it ends up that I pledged, you know, almost twice, I think, one time. But, hey, when you get older, you forget those things. maybe I didn't this year. I don't know. The second point is that for the colonoscopy, and you know, you performed that on me a couple times.
Sorry.
Is there anything new? I mean, there's one that's sort of like an X-ray, or what is that?
The virtual colonoscopy.
But that's not considered effective, right?
Well,
it misses some.
There are certain situations where it can be very helpful. And I know there are some areas on the East Coast, I think it's being used a little bit more than it is around here, just for screening exams in patients that are low risk. The only issues are that you still have to go through a prep. They are not evidently describing polyps that are real small, but they're just saying, well, we're going to suggest you have this again in 3 years. So then you worry about exposure, the radiation exposure risk. Mm. And if you do find anything sizable, then certainly you're going to have to end up having a colonoscopy anyway. But there are certain patients that they cannot have a colonoscopy done. It's not physically possible. And in that situation, it might be helpful.
Yeah, I think in mine, in terms of but is there something in terms of age? If you're healthy, is it cut off at 75 or some or other? But if you're healthy, you could still get the colonoscopy?
Somewhere between 75 and 80, we're supposed to quit torturing people with this. And, I like to think that the procedure itself is not so much torture as the prep itself, which is also necessary, but... there is some sedation risk. It takes time for polyps to develop and actually grow into any cancer, at least 6 to 12 years. And so certainly you need to think about, you know, if the patient has a lot of medical issues and they're just probably not going to survive that long and have that long of a life, then, you know, already at 60, then maybe you should be thinking about what are you doing with the colonoscopy. On the other hand, I have patients that have had recurring issues with polyps. Every time I look, they just are growing them frequently, but they're extremely healthy, and they will probably live to at least 90 and beyond, so I'll have a little bit of an issue stopping too early. So it's a bit of a judgment call, but, you know, point taken that we're not supposed to be just doing this without thinking about what we're doing and why and the efficacy.
Well, it's never been torture with you. So
thanks. You're very nice. Thank
call.
You.
Well, that it just real quick here, and I have some other callers. I guess one of the things that I wanted to raise with you was we seem to be at a time now where there's being a lot of reassessment of routine screenings.
Right.
So we've had some changes in recommendations for pap smears. There's a big debate going on about checking men for their prostate. And, right. You know, do we want to do that blood test every... So, and there are questions about, well, how often do you check for cholesterol? Do you check people's blood sugar? How often should women have mammograms? I mean, there seems to be a lot of discussion about that. As far as screening for colorectal cancer is concerned, any big changes in what's being recommended?
Overall, probably not. Things that we have talked about before, around age 50 is when you should start having a screening exam if you're a low-risk patient, meaning no family history and no other issues. And then every 10 years, if nothing is found, every 3 to 5, if depending on the number of polyps and the size of the polyps, et cetera. And family history, again, you get thrown in there. The biggest thing is probably, again, from outcomes research saying, okay, look, what are you doing after age 75 to 80? Why are you doing screening colonoscopies in a low-risk population? And it's just things that we should think about without just doing blindly.
Yeah. And is it still recommended that at some point, just every year, people should do the test for blood in the stool?
It's not recommended if they've had a full colonoscopy with a good prep. It can be real frustrating when I get patients occasionally that will have had a stool. They had a colonoscopy last year. We did the blood test in the stool, and it comes back positive because it's not that great of a test, unfortunately, mm-hmm. both positive or negative. And then you kind of stuck with, well, we lost a year ago. What do we do now?
Do you do another? And, reason to do another one?
Yeah, it's not usually. Unless the prep was not good or there's some extenuating circumstances. So,
okay. On to some other callers here. Line 3, Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I have an infant who took Prevacid for reflux for about 2 months, and it definitely helped her with the symptoms she was having regarding her reflux. But I noticed some symptoms of the medicine, too, and I'm wondering if any studies have been conducted on the effects of changing the acidity of the gut with the natural bacteria colonies that live there.
I'm not aware of any studies that look at bacteria that are naturally in the gut affecting acid production. It's an interesting idea, actually. The only place that you're supposed to have bacteria, however, is in your colon. You're not supposed to have bacteria in your stomach, and you're not supposed to have it in your small intestine. So, you know, there would not be any change there directly. So otherwise, I am not aware that there's been any studies on that.
Okay. Does changing the acidity of the stomach affect the acidity of the colon?
Probably a little bit. As things pass out of the stomach, you have secretions that occur in the gut for it to become non-acidic by the time it gets into the more distal, into the lower small intestine, because otherwise you'll get ulcers form. And the same is true of the colon. But it probably does affect it somewhat.
Thank you.
All right. We are just about the point where we're going to have to finish. I don't know how much someone is interested in whether you can say something about chronic cholecystitis.
Yes.
Is that something that's a long conversation?
Chronic cholecystitis is chronic inflammation of the gallbladder. Some people, rather than just having one episode of pain, need to have their gallbladder out. Other people just have kind of a smoldering inflammation, and that's what that's all about.
I guess maybe maybe what's on the person's mind is, you know, when do you get the point where you just take the gallbladder out? I mean, how do you make that decision?
It depends a little bit on the testing that's going on and the symptoms that you're having, and if you're reasonable for surgery or not.
Well, I think at about that point, we're going to have to finish. And my apologies if we didn't quite get to everybody's question. We hope that was helpful, and we certainly appreciate Dr. Nugent, Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist from Christie Clinic. Thanks for your time and for many hours of your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
All right.